Good morning. Please be seated. Well, I want to begin by welcoming everybody to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And just as we have been welcomed in Bemidji and Beltrami County, we, of course, most often sit and hear oral arguments at the Minnesota Judicial Center in St. Paul, but we also from time to time travel throughout the state and hear arguments in cases in the districts from which they arose. And we always rely upon the cooperation and hospitality of the district court staff who have been great today. So we appreciate that very much. We say thanks to them and we are happy to be here. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is September 11, 2024. This panel of the court has three cases set for oral argument. There was a fourth case which got rescheduled to next week by the Zoom format. But we will hear oral arguments in three cases today in person. We do have live streaming available for people to observe, but all arguments will be presented by people in the courtroom. I think counsel are likely familiar with our standard procedures. Normally an appellant has 15 minutes for the initial presentation, respondent has 15 minutes for a responsive presentation, appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal. That's the same when we have a cross appeal as well. So you each get 15, 15, and then five. And we have a clock there, which I think you can see, which will count down. I'm gonna warn you now that when it gets to zero, it will shriek really loudly and it might make you jump. So I hope that by mentioning that in advance, you're not as surprised as you otherwise would be. So having said all of that, I will call the first case. The first case is case number A23-1228, Craig Gerald Mackey versus Beth Ann Mackey. Counsel for appellant, you may approach the lectern. Please begin by stating your name and the name of your client or clients.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Christina Hewson, spelled H-U-S-O-N. I represent the appellant, Mr. Gerald Mackey, M-A-C-K-E-Y. You ready for me to begin?
Yes, you may begin.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Today's appeal comes out of a dissolution of marriage case. There was a judgment and decree entered by the trial court after a three-day trial in Itasca County, Minnesota. The parties lived together for about 33 years. They had two children. They were adults, and this doesn't deal with any of the child things. There are three main focuses that I'm going to highlight today in my oral argument for you. One, did the trial court abuse its discretion and error when it failed to dismiss the motion for amended findings and instead sua sponte, treating it as a motion for reconsideration? My second argument deals with the amended findings. And so that, did the trial court abuse its discretion and make amended findings that are clearly erroneous and against the facts that are within the record? And my third argument then is, did the trial court abuse its discretion in not modifying appellant's spousal maintenance obligation? So I'm gonna give a little bit of background and I'm gonna use my time to focus more on the procedural history rather than the factual history of this case.
Ms. Hewson, can I just stop you? Am I correct in understanding that all of the findings that you're challenging in the second part of your argument relate to the award of spousal maintenance? That's the subject of your third argument?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct. So procedurally, I need to back up so everybody can understand how we got to where we are. So there was a judgment decree issued. And that was issued after the trial. After trial was ended, the record was held open so that the parties could choose to submit proposed findings or a memorandum of law. Appellant chose to submit proposed findings. Respondent chose to submit a letter argument. So After that, the court issued its judgment and decree. The appellant filed a motion to correct clerical mistakes. So there were some simple things about the legal description of the property, just some errors. And then to deal with, there was some inconsistencies within the judgment and decree about the start date of spousal maintenance. So it needed to be consistent. One part said one date, one part said the other. So it was a simple motion to correct those, to find out where we were at. The response then that came from the respondent was they brought a motion for amended findings. There was no memorandum blah, there was no affidavit with that.
Can I ask a question about that? Is it your position that that the respondent was required to file a memorandum of law
in order to submit
a or an affidavit for a motion for amended findings?
Yes.
And where do you see that? Because as I'm looking at the rule, it says that, you know, they at that when they file their motion, they must file any memorandum of law that they intend to file, but I don't see a requirement there. Where do you get that?
Well, Rule 52.02, motion for amended findings they have to explicitly state and identify the defects and explain how evidence on the record does not support what the trial court found and why they're trying to change it. Then if we look at rules 303.02 and 0.03, which are the rules of general practice for family court, they say that all motions need to be supported by an affidavit or a memorandum of law, or they are improperly before the court. So, yes,
it is. And so in that sense, that the district court doesn't have the authority to consider a motion that isn't. So I could see a point where the district court may have had the authority to dismiss or deny a motion because it didn't have accompanying documents, but does the district court not have the authority to reach the issues, even if there may be defects in the filing like that?
Well,
it's not within the court's discretion to consider the arguments anyway.
Well, and I think this is kind of related to another point that I was going to bring up is there's a reason that we have this rule and it's required, and it's a due process requirement, because you need to put the other side on notice and give them an opportunity to respond. So basically, if you look at their motion for amended findings, it looks like proposed findings. You know, it says stuff like amending this finding to save this, and then they put their language, and they have that opportunity to do that in their submissions. So the case law is very, very clear on this. I mean, under the Lewis case, you can't just come in and re-argue. This isn't a second bite at the apple. This is to come in and say, look at Your Honor, I think you made some mistakes. Look at this evidence and this law, and look at it should be like this. The idea being, it prevents us all from spending the time and money from being here. So it gives the trial court the opportunity to fix those. And so there's a reason we have these rules and we require that. So when you just submit, kind of what I viewed as a wish list, you know, we wanted to say this, we wanted to say that. There was no law, there was no facts, there was no indication that we're relying on this. And if you look at this testimony or these exhibits, this evidence leads to this conclusion, Your Honor. Take a look at it.
Well, counsel, would you help me out on that issue? I did read your briefing on it, and I understand what your point is, I think. Would you give me an example of the issue, specific issues in this case? Because you did ultimately file a response to wife's motion. So what issue in particular, in what way were you prejudiced so that you were not able to understand an issue that the district court ultimately ruled on? I mean, do you understand
my
question?
Well, what it felt like, I mean, when we went to this, when I got the pleadings and looked at it and thought, well, how do I respond? I mean, it wasn't really like I could even create a legal response because it was just the same stuff as before, right? It's the stuff that...
I guess what I'm struggling with is I read both your briefing on appeal as well as what happened in district court as still having a clash over whether the district court should amend certain findings and the ones that the wife's submissions identified. So I'm trying to understand where you claim to have been prejudiced by this perhaps slightly different course of events.
Because I think if they would have done a motion that said amending finding number one, that says this, and here's what's wrong, and point to the evidence. That's why I think you need a memorandum or an affidavit.
But can you give it to me in a specific issue? Like one of, I'm just going to say spousal maintenance. On the spousal maintenance issue, was there something that occurred during the course of the motion to amend where you were caught off guard or surprised or unable to respond? Or I'm just trying to, the expense issues, I mean, something like that.
Yeah, I didn't understand what they were saying was a defect. So I didn't know how to legally respond. I mean, I knew what their position was at trial. Obviously, I understood that. We spent 3 days in trial and I understood their position. But I didn't think that I was showing up to re-argue the trial issues. I thought a motion for amended findings was going to be limited to errors that were made like that. And it just seemed like we were kind of coming back and it was like a whole redo of everything. And I didn't really understand what their legal point was. I mean, I understood that they disagreed with the court, but I didn't understand their legal basis for it.
Can I ask you a question on the cross appeal with respect to the issue about marital property and the 5.7 acre land on the cabin property? So the respondent cross appellant here argues that was actually marital property and shouldn't have been deemed non-marital property as a gift from a family member. And, you know, the deed says that it was gifted to both spouses at the time. And I guess I'm having a little trouble getting past the Olson case, which there it seemed like there was a deed that had both names. And the court, this is the Minnesota Supreme Court, indicated that you need, you know, some substantial evidence to overcome a presumption that the gift was not marital property, and particularly some evidence there about that it was not given to one, intentionally not given to one spouse, as opposed to, I wonder if you can, you know, clarify, is this different than that case? And if so, how?
Well, I do think it was different in the sense of, I mean, obviously the law is very, very clear, and there's a lot of cases in there that say title is not determinative of this. And even when you, title doesn't determine a character. And there's a lot of other cases that say just because something's jointly titled, it doesn't lose any non-marital character for that. I mean, they're probably not all in my brief because I would guess that there's probably hundreds of cases that say that. So I guess what this comes down to is, you know, so we have these two parcels of land, one that is approximately 11, one that was this 5.78. And so it all comes down to the donor's intent. And I think the Olson case, which you were referring, Your Honor, talks about that. Mm-hmm. It is all about the intent. The donor's intent then is a factual finding, what the donor's intent was for. And so this trial court found that the donor's intent was to gift it solely to the appellant, Mr. Mackey. And what was that based on? That was based on his testimony that is what his father relayed to him. It was based on his stepfather's testimony that said that that was very clearly the intent, on the fact that this family had been solely in his family for 90 years, and on the testimony about that the relationship that the father of my client and his daughter-in-law was not great.
But was that true at the time of the gifting?
Well, I would have to go back so I don't misspeak to you and look exactly at the testimony. But I believe so. I believe that it went through the entire marriage, that they weren't really close, and that went on for years. So I think when I get back to that, I mean, there was no evidence other than, well, it's titled in both names. So if you were to go with their argument, then you would be saying, well, it's all about titling. And that's not it. That the law is very clear that it is not all about titling. We have to look at the donor's intent. And so if you look at the district court, and that's a credibility determination and a weighing of the evidence, then it shows trial court made a different determination. And so I think the law says, you know, even if there's evidence to come to a different conclusion, this court should affirm the trial court when it comes to credibility determinations, even if it would have came to a different conclusion. So I think the trial court came to the conclusion that the donor's intent was to give it solely to the appellant. Okay, so I'm going to jump back to the motion for reconsideration now. Okay, so on the motion for reconsideration, I mean, the whole point about these is that you If you look at the Lewis case, you can't just re-argue the same facts. You have to come in and say that there's been some errors and here's why, and we need to correct them. And to this day, I still don't understand what those legal basises were. I mean, if you look at, I mean, it's just a motion. It looks like more like a proposed findings request.
So counsel, assume that we reject your first issue, right? So that we do think it is within the district court discretion to consider wife's arguments and to proceed. So help me out with what do you think your strongest argument, because obviously you have a lot of them and that you're, we're going to look at each of them carefully, but looking at the time on the clock, which of those do you think are, you know, is your strongest issue and you want to make sure that we talk about today?
Well, I think the whole way that this went down, I mean, I think it's a complete violation of due process because there's no notice or opportunity to be heard. I mean, on a motion for reconsideration, very specific rules. They're prohibited in general unless you follow the rule. The rule says you can do a letter to the court, no more than 2 pages, requesting it, respondent can do a 2-page letter saying why it shouldn't happen. None of this happens. So
I want to piggyback on Judge Bradfield's question by asking this, which finding of fact that you believe is clearly erroneous is the one that you think is most impactful and also your best argument, your best way of altering the financial calculation?
Okay, so I'm gonna jump ahead. There was five findings of fact, one that dealt with appellant's expenses, four that dealt with respondent's expenses, if we're talking about the amended findings. Obviously, you read our brief. We think there's an abuse of discretion. They're all clearly erroneous. I could go through in detail. I have a minute and a half left here on each one, but I think it's very well outlined in our brief. But I think the most egregious one is just like making up a mortgage payment. Oh, well, you might have this mortgage payment. I mean, I think there's case law that says you can't do that. I mean, it's very clear. The RASC case says it's an abuse of discretion to include a mortgage that's not being paid and there's no evidence of when it will. So not only is it completely inconsistent with law, how she came up with the amount, I mean, it kind of shows a little bit of where the thinking was and that it's not following in line with what's required. In that she looked at appellant's mortgage payment and said, oh, well, okay, well, maybe we'll give her half. I mean, it doesn't have any bearing in reality. It's arbitrary and capricious.
So I have a question about that. Is that, the district court weighed the testimony and weighted against the appellant's ability to pay the maintenance costs. I mean, isn't that kind of the type of balancing that district courts do in this case, that it's not necessarily an exact amount here or there, but you weigh kind of what the cost looks like it would be based on the testimony, and then you weigh it against the ability to pay maintenance, and the district court settles on that 500-ish number? So I guess I'm just wondering where the error there was. Like, is it in the amount that was set or the basis for the amount?
I mean, one, you can't make up expenses. And two, if you are going to come up with an expense, you have to have a basis in the facts. So that's I think on both counts, it's erroneous. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hoosen. You will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please approach. Please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Ellen Tholen, and I represent Beth Mackey, who is the cross appellant, and Ms. Mackey is present here today. I would first like to address, Your Honor, since we've been talking about this projected expense, I would like to bring the court's attention to the case of Newsky versus Newsky. It's a December 2020 case, and I'm sorry, the only citation I have for it is A20-0117. That is the case that supported the fact that a mortgage payment that was based upon a prior monthly mortgage is certainly an acceptable basis in fact. So Ms. Hewson's arguments that projected expenses are egregious, you know, that it's arbitrary and capricious, simply fails. Case law does support, as long as there's a basis in the law for that, because what does Ms. Mackey do? She has a projected expense because she's basically wanting to get out of the rental property that she was awarded. She wanted to enjoy somewhat a standard of living that was enjoyed during the marriage. So that is where that expense came from. That was a temporary residence. We all knew that, and that's why projected expense is appropriate. Just like her expense to say, look, I'd like to keep a lake lot, $250 a month where the camper was parked because we lived on a lake. I want to enjoy the lake. That expense was
ridiculous. I'm curious about the camper. So the request is for 12 months of rental of, for the
yes
of some sort of a lot yeah. for the camper. So is this a year-round camper in Minnesota? That just seems kind of interesting.
Right. Well, and that's a
and
good point.
I like
point.
Winter camping, but I just wanted to ask.
Yes, yeah. She's not using it during the winter okay. months, but I believe it's still parked. At
yeah, and that's the point. It's having yes. a place to park yeah. it. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
And so talking about that, so projected expenses mm-hmm. are certainly permitted.
Well, sorry, I would maybe I'll just ask you going back to the mortgage payment. So it's not even taking the point that projected expenses may be appropriate. You know, I was reading the Rask v. Rask case that talks about, you know, as an example, it was an opinion of our court about a mortgage payment where the court found that kind of estimating in that case, it was $600-something a month with no evidence that, you know, that the individual was going to move or when it would happen, that type of kind of more speculative amount was not an appropriate consideration. So how is this different? What evidence, I guess, how is this case different from Rask? And, you know, what evidence is there that this is not just a hope for the future to move into a new home and be able to pay this mortgage, but that it's actually, there's some concrete evidence that this is happening.
And Your Honor, it was testified to, and to update the court, the rental's been sold. She's waiting to buy. Mr. Mackey still hasn't even refinanced the property, so she's still on the Moose Lake mortgage.
So would you, again, it's just me trying to understand the facts. When you say the rental has been sold, you're talking about the property in Keewatin, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And it isn't that that Ms. Mackey was renting it. It's that it was
yes.
purchased with the idea that it would become rental property.
It was rental property. They
and
had the Moose Lake property that's in dispute, non-marital versus marital.
Right.
That was the homestead of the parties.
Yeah, that's what
that
I
That was the homestead. The Keewatin property, they did rent it out. When they separated, for convenience, Ms. Mackey just moved in there. That's right. why
but
we-
She's not holding on to it to then keep it as rental property. You
nope.
said she just sold it.
No, nope, she can't afford that.
Yeah, and that was not in front of the district court,
nope.
all that.
Nope, just that she was not planning on that being her long-term residence.
Thank you.
And I would like to then switch gears and get to this motion for reconsideration argument that Ms. Husen has been making. It's clear that the district court understood the motion for amended findings. And if you look at the motion for amended findings, it's very specific. It does incorporate the law. Rule 52.02 requires that it's based upon the trial court record. There is no necessity for an affidavit. We were not bringing a motion for newly discovered evidence. There was nothing new. So this motion for amended findings, and that's how I do them. Rule 52.02, if I'm making it based upon the record, it's very specified, it's very specific. It explains each finding and why each finding that I'm asking to be changed was incorrect. The district court agreed with a portion of those. And the district court very specifically indicated in paragraph 20 on, it would be appendix number 38 of Ms. Husen's brief, that it does say that the majority of these requests are in effect a motion for the reconsideration of matters litigated through trial. Some, however, are appropriate where they have drawn attention to account for these various changes, less apparent at trial. This judge did review it properly as a motion for amended findings. There's no prejudice. There's no prejudice. So court denies it. Do I go back and then I write a letter and I say, geez, judge, will you reconsider these findings? There is no prejudice. It was a motion for amended findings. As far as the non-marital, I'd really like to hit that non-marital. It's illogical for a court to determine after 32 years that the parties, Mr. Mackey, treated that property as joint property. Ms. Mackey is a Mackey. She's still a Mackey. Stepmother's still alive. Mother's still alive. They didn't come in and testify and say, oh, we did not want Ms. Mackey to have it.
Did you have any evidence contradicting the evidence of the stepfather? I think he relayed conversations he had had with Mr. Mackey's father, correct?
Correct. And Mr. Kohler's testimony, he couldn't even really recall when the deed was transferred. That evidence.
The district court did find Mr. Kohler credible with some, you know, problems or limitations in memory, and that's probably what you're referring to.
Right. Limitations of memory over 30 years ago, and somehow he was privy to this non-marital gift. If Mr. Mackey wanted to give that property only to his son, he would have done so. If Mr. Mackey wanted to give that property and retain something, he could have done a limited warranty deed. He could have done many, many different things. He did not. And are we getting to the point where we are going to discriminate against people because of their marital status? Because that's what happens when we take a 30-plus-year-old deed. The donative intent is that deed. It's a legal instrument of conveyance.
So the case law doesn't say that, does it? It doesn't say it that clearly or categorically.
If you look at the facts of this case, it's very clear and logical to draw that conclusion. Mr. Mackey himself treated this property as marital property. It wasn't even in their initial petition. It was something that was created after the fact.
So, Council,
he had mortgages, you know, and all of that. And just on that, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, I wanted you to finish. The facts are helpful to us, but we really need a case that you rely on in particular for this, especially in this scenario where there is a deed that says one thing, there's testimony that says something else,
right.
District court found it credible. So what case law would you rely on to say that on appeal, we should now right. do overturn the district court's finding on that? That's a dramatic thing that we don't normally do in
right.
a bench trial.
And what I would say to that is there's a 1911 case, and I can't remember the name of it in my brief, about the donative intent and the deed. However, I think what Ms. Husen is trying to argue, and maybe what the court is struggling with, this isn't like an application of common law when we do non-marital versus marital. 518.003 very specifically says this is what marital property is, and they only carve out four exceptions. The one exception that they apparently are trying to rely upon is, or not rely upon, but I'm relying upon, is if there's a third party who makes a gift under 518.003, they make a gift to one party and not the other. Mm-hmm. And not the other.
Does there need to be some specific evidence in the record, or how, you know, when we're reviewing the district court's finding here, are you saying that we need evidence that it was intended to not be gifted to one party, or
yes,
or could there be, you know, or because it seems like that's maybe what we don't have, but I guess I'm wondering, is that what we would need in order to overcome the whether it's a presumption or whatever, that it's marital property?
Yes, that he didn't want her to have it. There was no testimony to that, that Mr. Mackey in 1991 didn't want his daughter-in-law
Let me
have the property. And there was the stepmother also gifted. She was on that deed. So, you know, it was the 30 some years they mortgaged the property. They put that Moose Lake property, their retirement home that he now solely has, and she's getting $3,000 for an entire property equalization payment. She should be getting $75,000, one half of the value of that property minus the mortgage. The other error that the court made too, why are we putting-
I'm sorry, can I just stop you on that quickly? Because I think what I'd like to understand is, how do you think that this issue about this, the marital property, or the what has been designated non-marital property, the 5.7 acres, mm-hmm. how do you think that influence or might, you know, have changed the district court's ultimate distribution of the properties? Because, you know, again, this isn't necessarily like a this exact dollar amount versus this exact dollar amount. You know, the judge here was dividing up properties and ended up giving different pieces of the respective parties. So I'm wondering, how would the, if this were to be redesignated, let's say, as marital property, how might that have changed the outcome here?
It would have changed the outcome because there would have been, number one, the mortgage would have been against the entire piece of real estate. What the court did is said, here, okay, you get your $63,000 piece of property with no mortgage on it, Mr. Mackey, and we're going to divvy up the marital value minus the 40-some thousand-dollar mortgage. So that even affected the amount of equalization payment on the real estate alone. The numbers on the real estate were appraisal numbers that were used by the court that were not appealing. The mortgage we're not disputing. So that if, even if you just looked at the two parcels of real estate and balanced that out, but that is why it does, it makes a difference of at least from $3,000 to $30,000 when I did the math on the overall distribution. And so if you look at the entire facts, it's illogical to say that that is a non-marital piece of property.
You've
saved it in the bankruptcy.
So you've argued that they treated it, or he treated it, like marital property. And I guess you're referring to maybe the use or the fact that it was mortgaged or?
All of it.
And in what case law, is there case law saying that that kind of use or treatment by the recipient of a gift can determine the character and perhaps even contradict the donor's intent? Is there such case law?
And I don't have that case law for you, Your Honor.
Okay.
I would have to hope that there might be. Maybe this will be the one.
Well, do I understand correctly that I understand donor's intent is, if not important, perhaps determinative. Am I wrong about that?
I think donor's intent is very, very important. And I rely on the deed for the donor's intent. But then you take the subsequent facts on Mr. Mackey's intent, husband and wife's intent. In 2014, they filed bankruptcy. He manipulated his income so they could do that. He went back and started earning a lot of money again, and that again ties into the spousal maintenance argument of he can have his discretionary income. But getting back to the marital, they say they always paid Moose Lake mortgage, always. They lost their Pokegama home in that bankruptcy. They prioritized that. All their marital money went into that retirement piece of property because that's what it was going
just
to be.
To be clear, the structures on the land were deemed marital property, and portions that they'd purchased together, improvements, those things were deemed by the district court to be marital property, right? We're just talking about the underlying land of 5.7 acres.
And the 5.7 acres, the real estate value was $5,400 in 1991. And then on the parcel code, it was 63.4 or something like that. And that's what the district court found to be the value. That's an illogical value also, because they punched a road in. It was totally, totally vacant land. They improved the lakeshore, the real estate. They bought additional acreage next to the 5.78 acres because this was their retirement home. This was their retirement home. All the facts show that. Mr. Mackey's actions for 32 years. Thank you. My time is up.
You may sum up if you wish.
Okay, Your Honor. After 32 years, Mr. Mackey has the entire retirement home for a pittance. And that is what makes it unreasonable and unfair. And this is why this court needs to reverse that finding, or at least remand it on that non-marital issue, because that is a significant issue in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tholen, excuse me. Counsel for appellant, Ms. Husen, you, as we discussed earlier, have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And of course, you may address either your appeal or the cross appeal as you wish.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to start with this non-marital characterization. So I think one of the things is, and we heard it again, and that's all going back to the deed. And I think the case law is very clear that we need more evidence on the donor's intent. And they keep talking about, the stepmother being alive and all this. They could have brought this evidence in. They could have brought all of it in. They could have questioned Mr. Kohler and asked him these specific questions, but they didn't. They brought no evidence in other than this deed and said, there should be a done deal. Well, that's not the law. And we did bring in other evidence. And the trial court looked at the donor's intent and made some issues on credibility with it. So I also want to clarify something just in case the court is not clear on it, in that, okay, this 5.78 acres, when the court valued it, they didn't value the structure. So, and they already kind of got a deal on it because they went with the appraised value, which is higher than the tax values. But then when they went to determine non-marital valuation of that land without the structure, the tax value delineates between structure and land on it, and then they only took the land value on that, which probably was a lot lower than the appraised value. I mean, had they went with these appraised values. So the structure on this was never included in that valuation. So I just want all three of you to be clear on that, that the court didn't include that valuation in that. This is solely the land that was included on that. And also, I mean, we get a lot of arguments here, and a lot of it sounds like, this equitable argument, and she, he has this retirement home and she has nothing. She has a brand new remodeled home that apparently she just sold. New fact. I mean, don't know what she's selling it for, but so every dollar is going to be profit, right? Brand new remodeled house that used to be 5 minutes away from her work. Nothing needed to be done. My client is living in a home without plumbing where they did put a septic in during the course of this. However, the shower and the sink still just run out into the ground. There's no regular central heating unit. I mean, this is not some palace when they talk about retirement home. This is a very rustic kind of like shack that needs a lot of work, and there is a lot of evidence about what that is. So
I have a question for you about that, about the home and the maintenance costs, or the request for maintenance costs. Do we look at, so it's my understanding from the record that that was kind of the condition of the home when the parties lived there together. So if we're looking at the standard of living, or the standard during the marriage, is that, that's what the home was when they were there. So when you're talking about repairs or improvements on the property that he might do in the future, is that an appropriate consideration for us here? And if so, why?
Okay, well, 2 points on that. One, even in their brief, they say that this, they argue that this was the pattern of the parties to fix homes, and they admit it in their brief and say they spent about $500 per month on all these homes. Number one. Number two, there was more evidence that more things were needed. I mean, there's clearly a lot more plumbing. There's going to need to be regular heating. The deck is rotting. There's a whole bunch of more maintenance to make this a really livable home. I mean, it kind of worked. And when they were in the middle of a dissolution and separated, he was on the road a lot. And so it kind of, and it was summertime, and it kind of made sense that he was just going to stay there and she could take the nice house because so she could have a shower and stuff. But, as far as like long-term, where we're leaving people, I mean, listening to them, you'd think that she's left with nothing. And he has a home that isn't really that functional. I mean, yeah, he's making do. But she has a brand new home, fully remodeled. And the court has decided to give her basically a second home, a camper on a lot. Doesn't have two homes. I mean, if we're really going to look at equalization, then...
You're not challenging the property division, right? I mean, your appeal is about spousal maintenance.
Right, but I'm just saying that.
I have a question.
Not as bad as it sounds.
At the outset, you mentioned your three arguments, and the second being challenging findings that were relevant to spousal maintenance. If we were to disagree with you on all five of those findings, whatever the number is, do you still maintain that the district court erred by not modifying maintenance, or does your third argument depend upon your second?
Well, that's hard to answer because I think what the court did is backwards. I think they wanted to keep the 1,000, and so they modified it and then said, we're keeping 1,000.
I mean, we're gonna probably think about it, analyze it in the order you presented it. But if we were to say none of those factual findings are clearly erroneous, and so then we're left with a calculation where I think the surplus and deficits were sort of balanced closer to equilibrium. But so given those facts,
right,
are you still maintaining the district court erred by denying the motion to modify?
Yes, because I think she's making more money. And I think, especially now with the sale, though, I mean, nobody knows what her expenses are now. So,
okay. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments.
Thank you.
The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days, always in writing on the internet, Monday mornings at 10 a.m.
All right. Thank you.